Matthew 5, verses 43 through 48. The 25th talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on July 25, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in a brief section of reduced sound quality during the first part of the teaching.
Okay, we are continuing in the book of Matthew. We're in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount. Today we're finishing chapter 5, which means that we are also finishing that portion of the sermon that is sometimes called the antitheses. That is, that portion of the sermon where Jesus repeatedly says, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." So, for example, "You have heard it said, you should not commit murder, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother is guilty," and so on. Or, "You have heard it said, you should not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman with lust commits adultery in his heart," and so on. Those kinds of statements. My argument has been that Jesus is addressing the way the Pharisees use the law to justify themselves as righteous people. Jesus starts this section by saying, "Your righteousness must surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees," and now each of the antitheses is exploring ways in which that is true. Each of the antitheses is saying, as I understand it, "You have heard the Pharisees use the Old Testament in a certain way to picture what a righteous person is like, but I say to you that they have distorted the Old Testament. They have missed its central important teachings." That's what he's been doing. Today, we're going to look at the last of those, starting in Matthew 5:43. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." Okay, so first of all, let's try to sort out what Jesus is doing with the Old Testament. It starts out in 43, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy."
There is an obvious first problem that we have to solve, which is that there is nowhere in the Old Testament that says, "You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." That is not a direct quote from the Old Testament. Evidently, Jesus is summarizing what the Old Testament is saying, or more accurately, I think, Jesus is summarizing what the Pharisees portray as what the Old Testament is saying. The Pharisees are saying, in essence, "Do you want to know what a righteous person looks like? The scriptures say, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, so do that and you will be a righteous person." It's fairly obvious where the Pharisees would get the idea that we should love our neighbor. There is an extremely important passage that we've already looked at several times in this section in Leviticus 19:18. I'll just read it quickly from verse 17. Leviticus 19:17, "You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So, as I say, we've referred to this passage several times already. It's one of the most important verses in the Bible, one of the most important verses in the Old Testament, and often referred to in one way or another in the New Testament.
In our passage, we see that Jesus is exploring the question, who must we love? So we probably ought to start by asking with this Leviticus passage, whom does it say that we should love? In verse 17, the word neighbor is used in parallel with the phrase, your fellow countrymen. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. So your fellow countrymen and your neighbor seem to be equivalent kinds of ideas. Likewise, in verse 18, then, the word neighbor is used in parallel with the sons of your people. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So in the context of Leviticus, the command is that they are to love their fellow countrymen, the sons of their people, their neighbor. That is, they are to love their fellow Israelites. A few verses later, this is taken a step further. Let's start with verse 33. When a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So this verse is addressing a possible issue raised by verse 18. If I am obligated to love my neighbor, my fellow countrymen, the sons of my people, so what obligation do I have to those who are living around me who are not Jews? They are foreigners. Has the earlier command specifically been focused only on Jews? No, the answer is, just as is true with the sons of your people, you must love the foreigner who lives among you as yourself. There's no difference in how you should treat them. So this very important passage tells the Jews that they must love their neighbors, which in the context is understood to be their fellow Jews and also any strangers living among them. That is, they must love every person in their community. They must love every person with whom they are going to come into contact on a daily basis. So, again, it is easy to see where the Pharisees got the idea that the scriptures command them to love their neighbor. We have a very explicit command concerning that in Leviticus. But where did they get the idea that the scriptures call them to hate their enemies? In what sense is that a representation of what is taught in the Old Testament? I think we can answer that question. To answer that question takes us into some of the more troubling territory in the Bible. Many people throughout the centuries have struggled with the sorts of passages we're going to look at briefly here, and many people today still struggle with them. I just have a handful of passages I would like us to look at. Let's start with Deuteronomy 7, the first verse. Deuteronomy 7, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. So, as students of the Old Testament, we have to take note. The same Moses who said, "You shall not take vengeance, but shall love your neighbor as yourself," also said, "You shall utterly destroy the Canaanites." To love the Canaanites would mean to treat them well, to act on their behalf for their benefit. But the Israelites are not to do that. They are not to love them. In essence, they are to hate them. They are to act against them, to destroy them. And this is a command from God. A similar theme is found in Deuteronomy 23:3. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you
Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. Nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loves you. You shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. But then, Moses goes on to say, you shall not detest an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not detest an Egyptian, because you were an alien in his land. The sons of the third generation who are born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. So Moses says that they are never to forgive the Ammonites or the Moabites. They can never become a part of the assembly of the Lord. Not if you were to go 10 generations down the line, they still cannot become part of the assembly of the Lord. But the Edomites and the Egyptians, that's okay. We can overlook some things with them, but we're going to wait. We'll third generation, then we'll decide that it'll be okay for them to come in if they want to. Perhaps the most infamous passage of all is found in Psalm 137. This psalm is a beautiful lament concerning the captivity of the Jews in Babylon. It starts, Psalm 137:1, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. So, as I say, a beautiful lament. Now the psalmist calls on God to judge those who brought this about. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its very foundation. O daughter of Babylon, you devastated one, how blessed will be the one who repays you with the recompense with which you have repaid us. How blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock. Obviously, that last verse has troubled many people over the years. One more passage, a passage that explicitly speaks of hate in connection with enemies. Psalm 139, this time, verse 19. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. So I think that it is passages like these that inform what Jesus is saying in Matthew 5:43. The Pharisees would sum up the scriptures as saying, love your neighbor and hate your enemies. And truly, we can see why they might do so. The Old Testament calls on them to love their fellow countrymen and any foreigners who agree to live with them. It also gives numerous important examples where the people of God refuse to forgive the enemies of God, but instead respond with rejection and judgment. So the Pharisees seem to have some justification in saying that love your neighbor does not extend to everyone. In the New Testament, Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan to speak to exactly that question. This was a live question for the Pharisees. How do we understand this command to love your neighbor? Who are we talking about? So in Luke 10:25, I'm sure you're familiar with this passage, and a lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said to him, what is written in the law? How does it read to you? And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he, Jesus, said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." But wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied and said, and then Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan in response to that question. This is exactly the sort of question that the Pharisees were asking themselves. I mean, it might seem strange to us when we first read the parable of the Good Samaritan that the question, "Who is my neighbor?" might seem like the weakest sort of dodge. He's just sort of flailing around trying to find some way to get out of it. But I don't think that's it. I think that they were seriously interested in the answer to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" Because when I look at the Old Testament, I see the command to love my neighbor, but I also see God urging the people of Israel to do things that are not loving and forgiving at all. We see times when they are called to act with unforgiving judgment against the enemies of God, against God's enemies, against their enemies. So the question is, how do we keep the law of loving our neighbor? Who qualifies as a neighbor? And of course, what is devastating about Jesus' parable is that he makes a Samaritan the hero. The Samaritans were exactly the sorts of people that the Pharisees would have said, "They are not my neighbor. They are the enemy. They are not my fellow countrymen. They are not the sons. They are hostile to the religion of Israel. They worship at another temple," and so on. So that's not my neighbor. That's somebody else. And it is very interesting that Jesus chose to answer the question by taking a Samaritan and making him the good guy in the story that he tells. Okay, so we can see that the question is a little more complicated, that we have this tension. How should we think about the relationship between the command to love and this picture of judgment that we see in the Old Testament? So I'd like to just think about these passages for a bit. This is my own reflection on how we might think about this problem before we look at what Jesus says. How is it that we explain the tension between Moses saying, "Don't take vengeance, but rather act in love toward your neighbor," and Moses saying, "Go in and destroy these people utterly"? How do we put that picture together? On the one hand, love. On the other hand, destroy. One way to explain it is to decide that there are different categories of people that we're talking about here. There are my people, my countrymen, my brothers, my neighbors, and then there are those who are not my people, God's enemies, my enemies. So I am called to love my brothers, I am called to hate and judge my enemies. This seems to be the way the Pharisees understood the situation. If I'm understanding the picture, this is how they would resolve the tension between those two things. But I think there is a better way of resolving this tension, at least how it seems to me right now, the tension between the call to love and the call to judgment. We can get a little hint of a picture of it in Romans 12:9, something that Paul says there. Paul says in Romans 12:9, "Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." On the one hand, we see in this that God is a God of judgment. One day he will judge mankind. He will pour out his wrath against all those who have rejected him. On that day, either you will be one of God's people and enter into his kingdom, or you will be his enemy who will come under judgment and destruction. So the Old Testament passage that Paul is quoting makes it clear. There is a vengeance of God. God will act to
revenge what his enemies have done in hostility against him. But on the other hand, as Paul points out, it is not my place to visit that judgment upon others. As a person living my life under God, I am not called to be the judge and executioner of God's wrath. So, with that distinction in mind, I would argue that all the examples of unforgiving vengeance we saw in the Old Testament are all in one way or another related to the idea of God judging his enemies. So, yes, Israel is told to wipe out the pagan nations in the land into which they go, but that is because God, the creator of those nations, has decided to judge them. They are idolaters. They sacrifice their children to pagan gods. They are openly and willfully immoral. And so God has decided to bring their time as nations on earth to an end. Now, God has a lot of different ways of doing that. Many nations rise and fall through the providence of God. But in this particular case, God has this unique relationship with the nation of Israel. They are entering into a theocracy. God is ruling over them as a people. And because of this unique relationship with them, he is doing something that he has not done before and is not going to do again. He is calling on them as a people to execute his judgment against the pagan nations. He is ordering them, in this case, to be the executioners of his judgment. But this is a very unique situation. It is not what I am called to. It was what they were called to at one particular point in history, in their relationship with God. So we could look at each of the passages and many other passages and explore the ways in which this is true, but I would just argue that all of the passages that picture vengeance rather than mercy and love against the enemies of God are all coming from that same sort of place. That is, God has the right to judge. God will ultimately judge. And it is not wrong to recognize that there are those who are the enemies of God, who are the enemies of God's people, and to get on board with the idea that ultimately judgment will be coming their way. We recognize that certain people have set themselves up as enemies of God. They oppose and hate him. And in one way or another, God's people are recognizing that God has the right to judge his enemies. The Babylonians have oppressed the people of God, and so it is right that God bring fierce judgment upon them. The prophets said that God would do that. The interesting thing in the prophets, you see this in a number of places, where God, through the prophet, is explaining, I used that nation to judge the people of Israel because of their unbelief. Now, you nation, how dare you raise your hand against my people? And there is a judgment that's coming upon you. So the fact that God judges and that God's people recognize that that is the case, that is a part of the biblical revelation. That is part of what we see as a fundamental truth about God. But that is very far from saying that I personally have the right to execute judgment against those I consider to be in the wrong. The principle I must live by personally is found in Leviticus 19. You shall not take vengeance, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And in essence, my neighbor turns out to be everyone with whom I come in contact. So, to repeat the issue as I understand it, I think the Pharisees resolved the tension between the passage that calls us to love and the passages that call us to vengeance in this way. The way they resolved the tension is, love your own people, God's people, hate your enemies, God's enemies. Because we can see examples of both in the Old Testament. But I would argue that a better way to resolve the tension between love and judgment is this. God will indeed judge unrighteousness, and once he even asked Israel to be the agent of that judgment. But that is God's business. The personal standard by which we must live is to love other people as we love ourselves. That is what I would argue is the coherent picture that emerges when I consider everything that the Old Testament says about God's will for Israel. Okay, so now let's see what Jesus says in response to the Pharisees' idea that we should love our neighbor and hate our enemies. In verse 44, he says, "But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." So, Jesus asks us to step back and think about the way God treats people. He gives the sun and the rain, the necessities of life, to both the righteous and the unrighteous. That is, both to those who are faithful followers of God and to those who hate God. Now, obviously, we have to think carefully about this argument because that's not the only thing that God does. If we're going to think about how God deals with human beings, it is true that he sends the life-giving sun and rain upon his people and upon his enemies, both. But that's not all he does. Sometimes he acts in judgment. At the time of Noah, we know the story, he sent too much rain and wiped out most of the people on earth. God stopped sending the sun and the rain on the Canaanites, in essence. Instead, he sent the Israelites to wipe them out. There comes a point at which God does not give merciful, life-giving things to those who are his enemies. Sometimes he acts against them. And Jesus himself often speaks of the future day of judgment when the enemies of God will be judged and destroyed. So, if we're going to draw conclusions from God's behavior in relationship to human beings, it's a complicated picture. But that doesn't mean that Jesus isn't right in what he says. I think he is. As we look at the picture, we can conclude from God's behavior. The world is filled with people who deserve his judgment. Someday he will execute that judgment. Sometimes he does it in this life. Often that judgment is delayed until the last day. But meanwhile, these are the days when he chooses to graciously sustain the life of many who hate him. The world is filled with people who reject God, and yet God responds by sending them the sun and the rain they need to survive. God has chosen not to give us immediately what we deserve. And so we must conclude, if God is choosing to be gracious to his enemies, then certainly we must follow him in doing so. Yes, there is a day of judgment coming, but it is not our job to execute that judgment. Our job is to follow God's lead. He has chosen to be gracious, and so we must be gracious as well. And then that is informed further, of course, by the specific teaching we have about our obligation to other human beings to love them as we love ourselves. In that way, we will be sons of our Father who is in heaven. And I think the idea here is the picture of how a dutiful son emulates the Father. True sons speak for the Father, respect the Father, emulate what the Father's doing, and so on. And so, in loving our enemies, we will be emulating our Father, who is gracious in the same way. We are to pray for those who persecute us. I think Jesus means by persecution here exactly the same thing he meant a few verses back in 5:11, when he said, "Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me."
We are praying even for those who hate us because we follow God, because we follow Jesus. Those who would seem most worthy of judgment, those who would be most our enemies because they seek our harm because we follow Jesus, instead are to be met with love. Jesus goes on to use a bit of logic to critique the Pharisees' perspective. He says in 46, "For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" Now, let's not get hung up on this language of reward, because it's an innocent word. It's not something to worry about. We're not talking about works, righteousness, or any bad stuff like that. The word reward here just is talking about the desired outcome. I do something for a certain outcome. I plant plants seeking the reward of them growing up, and then I can eat the fruit or whatever. So the Pharisees, obviously the question about what is righteous, what does the law describe as righteous, how does one behave to be a righteous person, they are seeking a reward. They are seeking the approval of God. They are seeking to find a place in the kingdom of God. That's not a bad thing. You and I are also seeking that reward. We want that outcome for the choices that we have made in this life. So that's great. That's the sort of reward they're looking for. But Jesus is saying to them, you know, your perspective doesn't make much sense. You describe righteousness, the sort of righteousness that God looks at and says, yes, I like that. That's the sort of person I want in my kingdom, as love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Well, who doesn't do that? Everybody does that. Doesn't everyone love those who love them? Doesn't everyone greet their brothers? That's just the way it is in the world. Why would God say you are a righteous follower of God just because you do what every single person does naturally? You think that the tax gatherers and the Gentiles will be judged, whereas you will be granted life in the kingdom, but your so-called righteousness is in fact no different than theirs. You might want to think about this, Pharisees. You have ended up interpreting the Old Testament in such a way that you have made a distinction that is no distinction. It has amounted to nothing. It doesn't really mean much. So we come back to his statement that love your neighbor and hate your enemy is not really what this is about. We're talking about loving all people, even your enemy. Okay, finally we come to the conclusion of this passage. Verse 48, therefore you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Those of you that have heard me teach on this before may remember that my perspective on this verse is somewhat in the minority. As I look around again, I just find a lot of commentators who understand this verse in a way that I do not. So I'd like to give you that warning. There are a lot of people who don't think I'm right about this. But it is often understood that Jesus is making this statement as a conclusion to this entire section, the antitheses that we have been looking at. So his point would be something like this. Your righteousness must surpass that of the Pharisees. It is not enough to abstain from murder. You must not even be angry. It is not enough to abstain from adultery. You must not lust in your heart. And then various more examples. And then he concludes, yes, your righteousness must surpass that of the Pharisees. In fact, you must be morally perfect and without fault of any kind, just as your Father is. And that is seen as the summary statement of his purpose in this whole section. You have to be perfect, absolutely perfect. And that way of reading verse 48 usually goes with the idea that Jesus' purpose in this section is to drive us to despair, to drive us to the cross. He says, you must be morally perfect, but the unspoken reality is, as we confront what he's saying here, we recognize that we can't be morally perfect, and so we despair and turn to the cross of Christ for
for mercy, which of course he doesn't mention at all in this passage, but this is sort of preparing us for the gospel in that sense. Now, of course, in an important sense, what I just said is true. We cannot be morally perfect. We need the mercy that Jesus brings through his cross. It is only through God's mercy that we are going to make it. So I'm not denying that. And there is an element in this section of that theme. We can't help, as we look the way Jesus is describing the righteousness that the law was really calling for, we can't help but notice that this is a challenging picture. Loving your enemy is not an easy thing to do. So of course, we are brought up short and recognize how we need the mercy of God. But I don't think that Jesus is wrapping up this whole thing by saying, yep, you have to be so much better than the Pharisees that you are morally perfect. You have no moral flaw at all. That's how much better than the Pharisees you need to be. I don't think that is what he's saying. Instead, I see verse 48 as the conclusion to this small passage that we're looking at today. And this is the word teleos, which gets talked about around here a lot. In this section, I would translate it more something like complete. And I think the logic of the passage is like this. Don't only love those who love you, love your enemy as well. This is the way God is. God does not only send the sun and rain upon his followers, he also sends sun and rain upon the unrighteous. It wouldn't make sense that God would reward you for being like the Gentiles who only love those who love them, would it? So, therefore, your love should be complete, not only for your friends, but also for your enemies, just like your Father is complete in his love. So the conclusion here is, he's been saying, don't only love these people, but love your enemies as well. And his conclusion to that section is, you must be complete as your Father is complete. That is, not that one-sided loving only those that love you back, but embracing the fullness of what, in fact, love is about. So Jesus is not saying you must be morally perfect, as I understand what's happening here. Jesus is saying you must follow your Father in being complete and inclusive in your love. Interestingly, Luke has his own version of this love your enemies passage. It ends like this in Luke 6:35, but love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. And I think it's interesting the parallelism of that structure. Matthew ends, be complete, just as your Father is complete. Luke ends, be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. I think that they are two different versions of basically the same idea. Matthew's be complete means be complete in your love. That is, include in your love those who have treated you poorly. In other words, don't treat people in keeping with what you think they deserve, but be merciful, which is what Luke says. Be merciful as your Father is merciful. That's what he does. He sends the rain on the just and the unjust alike. He is merciful. Luke says, be merciful as your Father is merciful. Matthew has, be perfect. Extend your love to all, just as your Father extends his love to all. So I think Luke provides just the tiniest little hint that maybe the way I'm taking it might actually be what's going on there. Okay, so a couple of last comments. In the end, Jesus is teaching something profoundly simple here and profoundly difficult. He is basically just repeating the idea that we find in Leviticus, we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. That is, we are to seek the good of our neighbor the way we would want to be treated, and it turns out that our neighbor is everyone, including those who mistreat us. Paul captures the central importance of this commandment in Romans 13:8, where he says, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not commit murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law." So Paul sees, now, Paul isn't addressing, there are two great commandments that Jesus talks about. The first is love God with all your heart, soul, and strength. That concerns my relationship with my Creator. And the other is love your neighbor as yourself, and that concerns my relationship with my fellow human beings. When Paul says the law is summed up in love your neighbor as yourself, it's a good chunk of what the law is talking about. All of the law that deals with the moral realities of how we deal with each other, all of that comes back to love your neighbor as yourself. I just can't overemphasize how fundamentally important I think what Jesus is saying here is. In this life, it is often difficult to know what to do. And what I mean by that is making moral decisions, trying to decide how should I respond to things in life. What should I do in this particular situation I have with another person? Should I speak up? Should I just let it go? Should I do what the person is asking me to do? Should I say, no, I can't do that? What should I do? How do I decide what is the right thing to do? I firmly believe that this passage sheds more light on how we should make moral decisions concerning other people than just about any other. And maybe this only represents the fact that I have only gotten so far in my thinking. But in point of fact, where I am in my thinking about how I deal with other people and try to sort out those difficult questions of what do I do, this passage is the guiding principle that I operate by. The guiding principle in dealing with each other is love your enemy. That's how we try to discover what it is that we ought to do as we deal with other people. That is, seek the good of every person, even if they have not sought your good. Should I say something to Joe about this problem? Well, that's a tough question, but I know one thing. My goal is to do good for him, just as I would want if I were in his place. This is a guide in all human relationships, I think. It is one of the hardest things we will ever do, but this is the signpost that Jesus has put up for us. Choose the road that leads to the other person's good. That at least gives us something, some touchstone, some way of trying to orient ourselves in the midst of difficult decisions. And then let's not forget that Jesus' primary purpose in telling this here is not the practical one of giving us guidance as to what do you do in specific situations. The issue that he's dealing with is the way the Pharisees are describing what is it that God wants? What does the righteous person look like? So what we really fundamentally have to embrace here is this willingness to accept the picture that Jesus is painting, which is coming from the Old Testament. This picture that I have an obligation to treat other human beings, other creatures of God, in the same way that I would want to be treated. It's not just a pragmatic guide to conduct. It is a personal choice that I have to make. Am I willing to see you all as being on the same level of importance as I am? In that sense, it's a very personal question of my relationship with God and the truth. Am I willing to see you as God tells me you are? So, love your enemy is a guide to how we ought to live, but love your enemy is also one of those places where our faith gets tested, where we confront it and have to ask the question, am I willing to look at this and see its demand on my life. There's one last point I'd like to make. The Pharisees were wrestling with understanding an important tension in the Old Testament. We need to be sympathetic, I think, with the difficulty of sorting this question out. It is that tension between the call to love and the call to judge. On the one hand, we are to love our neighbor. On the other hand, God calls for judgment on his enemies. How do we live with that tension? This is a tension that all peoples at all times have had to wrestle with. We have had to wrestle with it today in our own time. It is one of the fundamental challenges that we face when we come to the Bible, the biblical worldview. How do I live with, on the one hand, this exacting standard of judgment, and on the other hand, the call to be merciful, to love, to not take vengeance? How do I put those things together? Many people today charge Christians with having taken basically the same road as the Pharisees. We are the sorts of people who love our brothers and hate our enemies. And in fact, I think some Christians have taken that road. We embrace our brothers. We embrace all of those who are like us. And then we basically turn away from the others, the ones that are different. Now, we may not reject them with the vehemence that someone like the Westboro Baptists do, but our attitude can be more or less that we reserve our goodwill for those who agree with us. This happens. This is not a straw man. This is something that religious people sometimes do in this world. And to them, Jesus would say, seek the good of all people, even those who oppose you. Another way of dealing with the tension between love and judgment is to basically play down and even eliminate the idea of judgment altogether. That is what many people see Jesus doing in this sermon. You're probably aware, this sermon is famous for being the place where Jesus basically says, you know, the God of the Old Testament is filled with judgment and vengeance, and that's so Old Testament. Today, we've got a new thing going. Today, we've got a New Testament, and we're into love and acceptance. When the Old Testament said an eye for an eye, it shouldn't have said that. That was wrong. When the Old Testament implied hate your enemies, with like the passages that we were looking at, it was wrong. It shouldn't have done that. Instead, the full and only truth is that we must love all people. There are many people who have sort of halfway accepted the biblical revelation. They would call themselves Christians, but their message is anyone who says that God judges is them being judgmental and hateful. Jesus has shown us the way. We are called to love, to accept. I hope that I've been clear in this series that I do not understand Jesus to be using the Old Testament in that way. Jesus affirms the teaching of the Old Testament as he said from the very beginning that I did not come to set aside, annul the Old Testament, I came to fulfill it. And that's what he's been doing in what we've been looking at. He has been affirming the full picture that emerges from the Old Testament. And part of the teaching that Jesus would affirm from the Old Testament is its teaching on the judgment that God is going to bring upon sin. The Old Testament proclaims that God is going to judge sin, but so does the New Testament. We can't really take the New Testament seriously and get around that. Jesus proclaims the judgment of God. He proclaims it not infrequently. Paul proclaims the judgment of God. The gospel is good news precisely because there is a real judgment coming, and God is offering mercy to those who turn to him. So we can't go down either of those roads. We can't join the Pharisees in saying The way to resolve all this is divide the world into my people and everyone else, and I love my people and I hate everybody else. I can't reconcile this by saying I'm basically going to dump the stuff that the Old Testament says about judgment and just love people. Both the Old and New Testaments proclaim two things, and we must embrace both of them. We personally must love even those who reject God, even those who reject us. And God is going to judge those who reject him. To follow God, to pursue true wisdom, we must embrace both of these truths. To emphasize judgment without love is a perversion, but so is emphasizing love without judgment. It is very hard in this world to embrace both truths. We will not be rewarded for doing so by the world we live in. Some people will hate us for proclaiming that God is a judge who will judge evil. Some people will hate us for showing love and compassion to those that they consider the enemy. But that is our call. We must embrace both of those truths. Okay, so that's what I've got to say for today. If you have any questions or comments, you can see this target that I have right there on my chest. You can take aim.
Thank you so much. This was really, really good. I am getting a feel for how hard it is to do Matthew, to understand all the nuances in the background. And you made me flash back on something one of the rabbis said about the factionalism and the schisms and the divisions between the schools, and they're all over Israel, and it was like that. And he said something like, this is where they heard it.
I'm sorry, said
you? He said, you have heard it said, love your brothers, hate your enemies. He says, well, that's where they heard it.
Okay.
In those deeply divided, with walls between them type of services and teachings. Okay. Is it possible that what he's talking about here is the ability the Pharisees had to label people their enemies and label them not their brothers, even within the believing tribes of Israel?
Yeah, there's an element of that. I'm not there, and it's difficult to sort out when you look in the rabbinic writings how much of it was at the time of Jesus and how much of it is a response to some of the things that happened that came out of the New Testament times. And so it's tricky. But I get the impression, yes, that it's very easy to move from, okay, there are the people of God, and then there are those who are hostile to God, and these are my people that I love, and these are the enemies of God that I must resist and judge. It's really easy to move from that to, and there's this brother who doesn't have all the answers right, and he's really irritating. And so even though I've been told that I'm not supposed to take vengeance against the sons of my people, it's just real easy for it to start to wander into the category as he's one of those enemies. Yes, I think probably it's just easy to imagine that that's the sort of thing that would happen. So I couldn't give you specifics, but I would be surprised if something like that was not involved. Yeah.
Feels like something they would justify, and not only justify, but they would make it serve them, that this works for me.
Right.
You know? And so my people in my group with our teaching, we got it nailed.
Right.
Therefore, you're on the other side of the wall of truth, and I can disregard you. I'll have to take care of your widow when she dies, because you're one of them. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I can't speak with certainty about what happened back then, but we can look in the Christian community over the centuries and see many examples of that same sort of thing. Seriously, one of the fundamental things that I believe about the issue that we face with the Pharisees and their misunderstanding of things is that it's not a Jewish problem, it's not an Old Testament problem, it is a human problem as to how you deal with revealed religion, how you deal with the call to righteousness and so forth. And it's just as likely to happen in the Christian church as it was amongst the Jews of that time, is that the truth becomes a tool that I can use to justify myself, to make myself look good in my own mind, to explain why I don't feel an obligation to you, or, you know, whatever that might be.
Hey, Ron.
Hi.
Thanks for what you have to say. You mentioned as a guide for then how we need to treat people to act towards their best interest or to do towards them as we would want them to do to us. And I can think of examples where that's pretty clear what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Good Samaritan story. If I was bleeding by the side of the road, I would want someone to bandage me. And then I can think of times where people have told themselves stories about how they were acting in another's best interest when clearly that's not the case, like the Inquisition and casuistry.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit about the sticky wicket, which is what is really in someone's best interest, and when does that look like opposing them?
Right.
And how does one go about doing that in a way that is loving them?
Right. Yeah. When we come to those hard questions, yes, that's one of those big issues that we always have to sort out. So I'm right with you. I don't know what I can say about it exactly, except to comment that it might seem loving to Jesus says, whatever somebody asks of you, the picture he paints is sort of whatever somebody asks of you, do it. But we can easily think of the classic example of, I know somebody and they're asking me for money, but I know perfectly well that they're going to go off and buy alcohol and drink themselves to death or that sort of thing. So thinking about what is loving in that situation, thinking about seeking their welfare, does not necessarily mean accommodating them, doing what they want me to do for them. In that sense, the pictures that Jesus paints are kind of striking examples of how I might have to ignore what I would like done in order to seek what is good for another person. So yeah, that's absolutely right. It's very easy to find ways of justifying our own behavior. So, I mean, love your enemy can become another one of those rules that if I keep that rule, that makes me a good person. And so I find a way of applying that and say, see, that's what I did here, without really facing into the hard reality that I'm not really thinking about what's good for that person at all. I'm really thinking more about what's going to be convenient for me or whatever. So yeah, those are all hard questions. That's where it really comes down to that willingness. When I think about it as a guide, I tried to indicate it's not that it tells me all the time exactly what I ought to do, but it's the hard reality that I want myself to confront. The fact is that my natural inclination in life is to seek my own welfare above that of other people. And I am called upon, when confronting choices, to look that in the face and say, wait a minute now. Actually, God has called me to consider this person as important as myself. What does that mean? Maybe it will be clear what that would mean. Maybe it's less than clear, but that's the truth that I have to confront. And confronting that truth is ultimately more important, I think, than figuring out what the ideally right response was in any particular situation. I'm convinced that many times in my life, I don't know, when I've had to make decisions, I don't know whether I did the right thing. I tried the best that I could, but, and sometimes then you turn around and you watch where things actually ended up and thought, you know, that was not a brilliant choice I made as to how to handle this. But the issue that Jesus is really concerned with here is about our righteousness exceeding that of the Pharisees. The Pharisees have removed themselves from even having to make that consideration by the way they have interpreted how you deal with neighbors and how you deal with enemies. Jesus is saying, no, don't do that. You need to face into what God really wants of you in your interaction with your fellow human beings. Okay, now we're dealing with reality if we're willing to do that. And maybe it'll be clear what I should do or maybe not, but that's the thing that I am either going to resist or going to embrace. That's kind of how I look at that. But you're right, the issues can be quite complicated. Anything else? Okay, well, you wondered if we would ever finish chapter 5. We did, so we're going into chapter 6.